President Lyndon Johnson, who was a president a while back in America, when he was once introduced at some sort of, I don't know, dinner or something like this where he was speaking, he was introduced in very over-flattering terms. And it's reputed that he said this in response: "I do so wish that my parents could have been present today. My father would have liked what was said about me, and my mother would have believed it." God does not flatter humanity. He does not say things which are not true. He gives us the brutal and honest truth. And that is really what we've been seeing so far in Genesis. We've been learning about ourselves as humans. We're in this series, Bible Stories for Grown-Ups, and so far we've worked our way through the beginning of Genesis. And really, we're in a section of Genesis that is like key stage one for humanity. But actually, this key stage one set of lessons is quite grown up. And the lesson we're learning today is, do not put your hope in man. That is God's lesson for us. If we're going to be human and not go through life disappointed and frustrated and pursuing dead ends and actually just doing ourselves harm, then we need to understand what God says about us. And God says, don't put your hope in man, in yourselves. And this brings us to our first heading. I put it there on my handout like this. Is there hope in man, or is this a new hope for man? As we start off in Genesis 8, the flood waters of God's judgment have now receded, and it could just be, we think as readers at this stage, that maybe there is hope in man, in our man Noah. So Noah has already been introduced to us as readers. Back in chapter 5, Noah was born to his father Lamech, and Lamech named him, and his name, Noah, means rest. Chapter 5 says, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one, Noah, shall bring us relief. So our hopes are pinned on Noah as this man who might reverse the fall and the curses that came about as a result of our rebellion. He might just be able, hoped Lamech, to get us back to Eden. That's the sort of backdrop. And perhaps he will actually, you know, bring about a new age in which society is redeemed and the world is transformed. Because in our reading, in Genesis 8, verses 1 to 19, we're getting these echoes of Genesis 1 when it all began, when God first created. And I think our hopes are deliberately raised in those verses. It's almost as if God is creating the earth for a second time. We were told that the waters subsided and a new earth sort of 2.0, emerged out of a watery chaos, just like when God created the world. And there's hope in the air. Look at the date in chapter 8, verse 13. In the 601st year, people lived for a long time back then. This is Noah's life. In the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, the waters were dried from the earth. This is the day Noah looks out to get ready to disembark from the ark. And you can imagine him, can't you? Maybe he's doing a journal entry and he scribbles down the date, 01-01-01. He thinks himself, a fresh start. And he writes in his diary, "Dear diary, what a day. The world awaits. It's been renewed. It's time to start again." And I don't know if people use hashtags anymore, but you know, the hashtags would be 010101, fresh start, hashtag living on the right side of history, that sort of stuff. And Noah's looking out, and everything feels quite kind of positive. The world has, after all, been rid of evil and corruption. God has wiped out evil humanity. And Noah is the perfect man for starting afresh. He's a righteous man, we have been told. He walked with God. He really was righteous in his conduct. And he's got this blank canvas, so our hopes have been raised. In chapter 6 and 7, we are told that Noah walked with God, and we expect him to continue to do so, and maybe, as a result, things will get back to the way they once were before the fall. So there's Noah. He's about to leave the ark. He gathers the animals and his family, perhaps, for a little speech. He says, "We are about to enter the world. We have an opportunity to change the human story." And then perhaps, of course, I'm just imagining this, but perhaps he quotes the famous Obama "Yes, we can" speech. "I say, yes, we can, to opportunity and prosperity. Yes, we can heal this nation. Yes, we can repair this world. Yes, we can." And on it goes, that sort of thing. So we're feeling optimistic, and we've got this question: is there a new hope in man? Should we rest our hopes on Noah? And the answer that our passage supplies is a resounding no. Do not put your hope in man. There is no hope, not even in the best man. There are so many details that draw this out, but look at verse 21. "When the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, 'I will never again curse the ground because of man.'" Now that's a good thing, isn't it? That God's not going to flood the world again. But why isn't he going to flood the world again and destroy everything? Why must he stop responding to evil with total annihilation? Because, the verse goes on, "the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth." So what God is saying is, I'm not going to respond to evil with another flood, because if I did that, I would just keep flooding the world, destroying the world, because man's heart is still evil post-flood. "Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I've done." It would just mean that humanity was wiped out forever. God's analysis of humanity after the flood, after this reset, is the same as it was beforehand. The intention of man's heart, humanity's heart, is evil from his youth. This is a restatement of what God has already said. The flood has changed nothing. We've reduced humanity right down to the best bloke we've got, but in terms of the human nature, even in Noah, nothing has changed. When I was younger, in my youth, well, not my youth, but when I was a bit younger, I skipped the dentist for 5 years, which is not a good thing to do. And I finally sort of went back to the dentist with my tail between my legs. And he looked at me and he sort of gazed and he said, "Tom, what's going on?" And I got a real ticking off. And do you know, it worked. I've now been to the dentist every 6 months. As he tells me, I was a reformed man because he told me off. Sometimes that works. The flood was the single greatest lesson of God's holy hatred of human sin that humanity has ever really had. But it didn't reform the guy that got to see the lesson, witness this lesson. Even the flood couldn't scare the rebel human heart into submission. Man's heart is still, in its intentions, evil. What this is describing is total depravity of the human nature. That's not to say that we're as bad as we could be. It's not utter depravity. That would be hell. That will be hell. But it's total in the sense that this corruption pervades every aspect of our humanity. So it's not just our actions and behavior crossing the line. It's talking about our intentions, the very drivers that are in us, our desires. They are evil, says the Bible, says the maker of humanity. And so, of course, God has to legislate against murder, verse 6. "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his image." So God anticipates that we're not going to respect the sanctity of human life, and we don't, do we, in our society, before life is born and as life comes to an end, and often in the middle. God anticipates we're going to trample on the dignity of humankind, which still bears his image. And we can obviously see that this is a true analysis as you look at how history then unfolds from this point forward. You think of Jesus' own time and the Roman Empire. Caligula would say to his executioners, "Make him feel that he is dying." the Vikings. Their pagan practices involved human victims being suspended in their sacred graves. Or John Newton, recalling the savagery of a captain on a slave ship, how he wouldn't just kill those who resisted, but he would make their death as excruciating as possible. This is real history, and it's us. It's us as humans that have been doing these things down the centuries. Because the intention of man's heart is evil. It's capable of the most unspeakable evils. Of course, we want to say, well, it's the 21st century. We've improved. And this has always been what we want to do as humans. We want to say, no, man's got it in himself. Humanity can improve. The Enlightenment was a movement that was saying that. Man and society are perfectible. That was the great idea of the Enlightenment, and it's now the air that we're breathing in our culture. And we're told all the time, aren't we, that we do have it in us to redeem ourselves and therefore our world. But we don't. That's what the Bible is telling us, to be realistic. We're just fooling ourselves if we think that. And we see that in our text because the examples of depravity that are given are very contemporary. So look at that first example there in verses 20 to 21. Here's our man Noah. He's the hero. He's the one person that we thought maybe could be the hope of the world. And it starts well, actually. In verse 20, he's tending the ground. Maybe he's overcoming the thorns and thistles of the curse, growing a vineyard. But look at him there in verse 21. He drank of the wine, and he became drunk, and he lay uncovered in his tents. This is just such an awful, disappointing fall for our hero. He's just like Adam, isn't he? Naked and ashamed. He's done what Adam did. He's misused the fruit of the ground. He's been working hard all day in the vineyard, and now it's wine o'clock, and he sits down with a bottle of wine, and he blows his brains out with booze. And actually, when you think about drunkenness, it is basically just checking out of being human for the night, isn't it? Martin Lloyd-Jones was a pastor, but he used to be a doctor before he became a pastor, and speaking both as pastor and physician, he spoke about alcohol, how pharmacologically it's a depressant. It's not a stimulant. It depresses our highest centers in the brain. And our own, perhaps from the past, sad experiences may be that we know how alcohol affects the centers that control our wisdom and understanding, our self-control, our discrimination, our judgment, our balance, the power to assess everything. It depresses all that really makes us at our best as humans, all that makes us more like God and less like the animals. But here's Noah, he just checks out of being human, checks out of being an image bearer, tramples that underfoot, and he just gets wasted. I'm not going to bother tonight. He's been the big man, you know, a little bit of that rebellious feeling that goes with drunkenness. And it's just so contemporary, isn't it? And then there's verse 21 and his nakedness and all that then leads to. And this is another very contemporary example of depravity that Genesis is giving us. www.police.uk tells us that voyeurism is when someone get sexual pleasure from watching, photographing, or recording others doing something that's usually private. For example, when they're naked. And voyeurism is an offense when it's done without the person's permission. And in verse 22, that is actually what's going on. Ham, verse 22, the father of Canaan, the son of Noah, he saw the nakedness of his father, and he told his brothers outside. The commentators say that in the Hebrew, the sense of the word saw is to do with looking at searchingly. He looked searchingly at Noah's nakedness. This isn't a sort of harmless accidental seeing. This sexual interest implied. He's been a peeping Tom. setting eyes where they don't belong, invading Noah's privacy, making it known to others. And it's depraved because it violates Noah's dignity as an image bearer. It robs him of his instinct desire for privacy. And I think very helpfully, one commentator points out, it is basically a form of domination. And actually, that's the dark underbelly of the sexual revolution and things like porn. Domination, being the big man, or being in control, or this kind of thing. And it's so contemporary, isn't it? These examples of the depravity that we see on the earth right there back after the flood. And the point is, it's not a beat up. It's a key stage one lesson about humanity. Humanity in the intention of our hearts is evil from youth. And you've got to remember that Noah is a model believer in the New Testament. He is a model believer, but look at him and look at his family. Look at what was capable, even of someone who was held out as an example of faith. So it's a heavy lesson, isn't it? Humanity is evil in its desires from its youth. And God is saying to us, don't put your hope in man. Obviously, we should want to get back to Eden, to think about the violence, to think about the shame of Noah and his son, to think about these things is dreadful. We should want to get back to Eden. We should want society to flourish. We should want redemption. But there is no point looking in the wrong place for it. And God says, don't look to man for the answer. It's not that we check out of being human beings. He's told us to be fruitful and multiply. Go on living. Keep sowing seeds in the ground. Keep doing your work, going to work, you know, being a human. And God's holding back the floodwaters, which should sweep upon us. He's saying, keep living, being humans in his world. But the reason he's allowing life to live on the earth is not so that we start looking to ourselves for some solution, but instead to him and the God-man Jesus Christ. This is where the Bible tells us to rest our hope. He is able to pull us out of the pit and to redeem us. He himself had his blood shed at the cross and was offered up as a sacrifice, a pleasing sacrifice that turned God's wrath away from us because justice was done. He hung naked and bore the shame and God's curse so that we can be clothed in righteousness, so that we can have God's blessing, so that we do not need to be ashamed. He won for us rights to a new world, and he calls us to come to him to find the rest that we're wanting, to pin our hopes in him. In Matthew, he so famously says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Here's some application for us. Here are five ways to be disappointed in life, okay? So if that's what you're looking for, here are five ways to be disappointed. Number one, set your hope in a political leader or political solution. You can take your pick. You could go for Corbyn on the left now or Farage on the right. They'll promise great things to fix our nation, to fix things. Don't be so naive, says the Bible. Do vote, but don't think you're voting for someone who can get us to Eden. Be realistic. We're voting for someone who will hopefully enforce law and restrain evil. Number two, second way to be disappointed, set your hope on having the perfect relationship or marriage or family situation or living situation or a dream home or something like this, a little slice of heaven down in Elephant and Castle or wherever it is. Pin your hopes on that and you'll be disappointed. Our hope is not in man, it's not in us, but it's in Jesus. Number three, disappoint yourself by setting your hope in your work. Get the job at, you know, whatever this firm is, it's going to change the world and play your part in transforming things. Or get on the team that's got the really golden boss, where work is just going to be so good because he's so good. Or get the job with all the perks. Rest your hopes there, and they'll crumble to dust. Put your hope rather in Jesus. Number four, another thing we sometimes do is put our hope, all our hopes, into having a sort of perfect church family, maybe even, or a church leader. We are all sinners. If we're expecting a society that never sins, that perfectly lives up to the New Testament vision, we will be crushed this side of heaven. We should strive for it, but we will fail, and we should be realistic and repentant, and we'll need so much grace and forgiveness. We cannot put our weight there. Finally, this is the one society just hammers home every single day. And it's a great way to be disappointed. Society will say, rest all your hopes on yourself. The pursuit of your deepest desires, go for them. And then your deepest hopes will find fulfillment. Achieve your potential. Live your dream. Live up to your standards. These things will just will be crushed under the weight of them, says God to us in this key stage one lesson. Don't do it. Set your hopes instead on Jesus Christ. The voices in the world are so romantic about human potential, and the thing is, it doesn't actually help anyone. It doesn't further the cause of humanity. The more we look to ourselves for the answers, the more we'll hurt ourselves. Yes, live in the world, but what the Bible is saying to us from this point onwards is rest all of your hopes for here and the hereafter on this man, Jesus Christ. And we can dwell on what that might look like in discussion time.